the sub-personalities and what function do they have? So, when we talk about sub-personalities, that's all psychology. I don't think in Vedanta there's any sub-personalities. I don't think they don't use that term or think about it like that. But when we use the term, sub-personalities are those parts that have been split off from the psyche into the unconscious because of trauma, one sort of trauma or another. And so it's as though a little piece of yourself from the standpoint of the mind, that itself, because sattva manifests consciousness, it's a little piece of yourself that's there in the unconscious. That when in, it's like taking that little piece that has some trauma, putting it in the unconscious, and then you can carry on a dialogue with it, right? Because there's actually a little being in there as though. So just a partial little part of yourself, of your psyche. And so as you grow up, especially when you're very young, these type of sub-personalities will be kind of stored in the psyche. Because for one reason or another, they kind of split off from your conscious mind and are stored in there. And so that's why you can feel when you're going into having that type of dialogue, you can feel the affect, you know. The affect is there inside, and the affect has an image, and you can talk with it, and it will talk to you, and it has feelings and all of that. And then when you've done that work of making that part of yourself feel safe and it kind of vents out all of the hurt and trauma and whatnot, it will eventually just, you'll feel it as almost as though it not explodes in any kind of a violent way, but just goes whoosh, whoosh, back into the psyche, into the conscious mind. And you actually feel that little girl or little boy, that presence is now like kind of homeopathy, has kind of filled your mind. So you can feel that she has joined you. And joined you without the trauma, but somehow that joining makes you feel stronger because you've gotten back some of your own libido, some of your own psychic energy has now rejoined the mind. And so when we're talking about sub-personalities, it's very much akin to, you ever heard of multiple personality disorder? That's now called dissociative disorder. So we say that in psychology, in terms of dissociative disorder, there's a spectrum from, you know, being totally contained in the conscious mind to different degrees of dissociation, to the farthest extreme when there's a complete dissociation. You know, and that's called person who has multiple personality, where that so much libido has been taken into that part of the personality that it can actually displace the ego or the conscious mind. That's called, and so that's when like a lot of terrible, terrible trauma has taken place, like sometimes in cults or in satanic cults and things like that are often used as examples for that, because the type of rituals and things they do are so chilling. That a child can be split into many, many parts. Those are all of those sub-personalities. The sub-personality when it's not as strong as the primary personality, means the primary ego structure. By ego structure, I mean antakarna. I mean, I don't mean the hankara. I mean the conscious mind. So in psychological language, the ego is the conscious mind. Where the I is, the me, sense of me, is there an ego, and then there's all this unconscious material that the conscious mind comes into contact. Be careful when you're studying psychology and they don't, these terms are used a little differently. So, what was the other part of that question? What function they have? The function they have is to protect the child from trauma that it can't handle. So say if the trauma gets too much, that part, it is a defense mechanism. You know, so if the trauma is too much, that part will break off and be held in this unconscious, and another personality will come that can more fit in to handle that. And then when that can't handle, that'll break off, and another, the the ego will come, the personality that can handle that keeps breaking like that. And then the one that becomes good at handling this particular thing, the sub-personality, will come to handle a specific type of trauma. Another one will come to handle another little job, little specific jobs, and they split up the terror and the trauma in that way. Because one ego is not able to deal with the whole thing. So it divides up, it divides itself up, some to 200 or 300 sub-personalities, sometimes in really jobs in reference to this surviving this kind of very horrible situation. And then for other people, they may have one or two sub-personalities that are strong enough to displace the ego. But normally, we will all have sub-personalities like the little children that we work with. They don't have the capacity, and that's normal. You know, they don't have the capacity, or they don't have enough libido to kind of push out the main personality, where they can get enough energy where they become stronger, enough psychic energy where they become stronger than the actual ego. In some cases, you no longer know who was the original person, because it's so divided up, and sometimes the sub-personality has a lot more strength than the other one. It's very complicated. And then to get them to talk to each other and to talk to the one who acts as the main personality, is part of the task. And in that way, by that communication, they start to join together, just as your sub-personality, the little girl inside, you know, will eventually, with that work, all the trauma will be dissipated and she'll come join back into the conscious mind. But our sub-personalities are not anywhere near what happens in dissociative disorder. It's way out here on the spectrum, whereas for us, it's just here, kind of in the normal range. For it, everybody has that. Just about everybody. So it's just, and that's why you have to go in and rescue those parts, because they're just held in there. They have no way of getting out except through projection. But if you go in as a conscious mind, then the two are meeting. You know, the little sub-personality is now being contained, being meeting with the conscious mind. And then it can actually release its trauma into the conscious mind. It takes a while. And for a while, it'll keep its own form, you know, its own protective defense system. And then it'll merge into the conscious mind. So that's all kind of in the realm of psychology. Can you talk about the relation child mother? Or child, can't really read what that says. I could say child father, it doesn't look like father there. The child mother, why is it often such a challenge in that relationship? Oh, daughter. Child or daughter, mother, daughter, for instance. I think that's what that says. Why is it often such a challenge in that relationship? Yeah, why is that? Why is that? It's not always challenging, but it often is, you know? Sure, why that is. I don't know that there's any pat answer, but one thing I've thought of before, which I noticed, especially with my one sister, two sisters had, one sister had two boys and a girl, and then one other sister had one boy. So I was kind of very involved and very much a part of those families as those children were growing up. So I got to kind of experience all of the dynamics and everything and be part of it myself because I was with them a lot of the time. And one thing I realized that in the... There is a great difference, at least in the West, probably here too, you'll just have to confirm for me, in the way that a daughter and a son are raised. It's very, very different. And the mother naturally identifies with the daughter to be like her, right, and to have the same duties and responsibilities in the household that she has, and that's what she passes on. Whereas what she passes on to her son is, you know, the way that she takes care of her husband and takes care of his needs and his looks at his responsibilities, the husband's responsibilities, somehow that gets more, lands a little bit more on the boy. And so the boy, in a way, gets much more attention, much more looked after, whereas the girl is expected to be taking care of everyone like the mother is. And so the type of attention that the girl gets is very different. It always kind of has a sense of, well, honey, we're in this together. she doesn't say that, you know, but we're in this together, and we take care of the family, and we take care of the home, and we take care of your father. And then the boys are kind of lumped in with being taken care of by the father. And the boys get a lot more, I don't know, they're just given a lot more, deference, you know. And the girls are not given attention in the same way. It's very, very different. It's not that they're not given attention, but the attention is much different. It's more of the attention of how you need to learn to serve like your mother serves, you know, rather than you being a little person in your own right and watching how you grow up and become a man like they do for the boy, you know. And we take care to make sure that you grow up to be a strong, independent boy. The girl is more being raised to be like the mother, by the mother, you know. And the father is similar. The father wants the boy to grow up to be a strong man who takes care of things. And he wants the girl to grow up to be like the mother, who looks after him and takes care of him. But they're not allowed, the girl isn't encouraged. It's all totally unconscious. It's not like we're going to encourage the boy and not encourage the girl. But the girl is often not encouraged to be just a person in her own right, you know, because she's being raised by her mother, who's not really a person in her own right. So I've noticed this, you know, over the years. Some people have talked about it. It's not always that way in every family, but it's often that way. And so the individuality or the individuation, you know, of the boy is much more fostered than the individuation of the girl. And I think that causes problems. By the mother, you know, and by the father in some ways, but sometimes not by the father as much as by the mother. Because by the mother, it's so unconscious because she doesn't know any other way to be. You know? And I think that can cause problems sometimes in the mother-daughter relationship because the mother's not a full person. You know, I think this is changing over the generations. Like my generation will be probably much more a serious problem than your generation, and then your children's generation will have much less serious problem over this than your generation. But mine was pretty, for the people, for the women, girls in my generation, it was pretty much that way, unless it was kind of a very unusual family, you know. Because it was all, it wasn't even in consciousness, except for a few extraordinary women, I would say, but normally in the society, not in consciousness. And then I would think that our own individuation is being denied, and our mother's individuation is being denied, and we don't feel very comfortable in that whole thing. We don't feel very comfortable with our mother because she's not a full person, and we don't feel very comfortable with ourselves because we're also not a full person within that situation, you know, within that matrix, unconscious matrix. And so I think that creates problems with the mother-daughter. The mother has certain values for her child, which are the values that she's swallowed, but which has actually not allowed her to be a whole person. And so we don't just take to it right away. But, you know, so it can cause some conflict. But it's not always the case. You can be very fortunate and have a mother and father who are kind of much more individuated themselves, both the mother and the father, much more individuated themselves. And then the children, I imagine, would have love and respect for both and want to be like mom and want to be like dad and all of that. But that's because mom is being like mom. You know, she's a real person and very, very well-seated in herself, you know. So I've wondered about this, if that could be the reason, other than just the normal archetypal reason thing of the child needing to separate from both the mother and the father. In teenage years, there's an archetype. I mean, it's almost an instinctual, God-given rite of passage where you have to separate from your parents and find yourself, and then you become like a rebellious teenager. I'll go through all this kind of stuff. Yeah. So, anyway, I don't know what you all think about that. But I don't even know if it's true. I just, it seems that way to me. Yeah. But things keep changing, and women are becoming more themselves. It's a slow process. I was lucky because they, for a reason unbeknownst to my parents, the reason that they did this was at the year that I was supposed to go into high school, three girls in the school got pregnant that semester, that, you know, before I was to go into high school. And my parents and the parents of some of my best friends just freaked out. And my father would not let me go to that high school, because all this stuff was going on enough to have three girls in one class get pregnant. So no, she's not going there. And so I had two really best girlfriends. And so somehow, I don't know who came up with this idea or how it happened, I don't remember. There was a Catholic school. None of the three of us were Catholic, but there was a Catholic high school in Santa Rosa, all girls school. So they decided to send us to that school. And so I went the whole 4 years to this all-girls school. And that was probably, and it was a really good school in terms of the education. But the interesting thing about being at an all-girls school is that you didn't have to go through this process of dumbing down so that the boys would like you, you know, which was very prevalent in my era. It's like you had to be pretty and not very smart, not very fast, not very outspoken, because the boys wanted that role. And so the girls would find themselves as they went into high school or into freshmen or sophomores to make sure that they didn't talk very much in class, they didn't raise their hand very often, they didn't speak out very much, They never showed their intelligence so that it might compete in any way with the boys. So there's this real withdrawal, dumbing down, just being pretty and popular and this type of thing, but not developing, you know, your being, your intelligence, you know. So there's a lot of thwarting of the girls. But in a girls' school, there's no boys around that you have to dumb down for at all. You know, and so everybody was very, all the girls were very vibrant, and then there was a boys' school next door, and then they would kind of meet, you know, and do what boys and girls do. But in the school and in the classroom, in the classroom, there was not that feeling of having to be popular or to have the boys like you. So then you were just allowed to be as you are. You didn't even think about that, you know. And when you start going to high school, that's right when all those, that puberty starts kicking in. And so that's the time when, right when you're going into high school, that's the time when all of these complexes and worries and everything start, you know. But if you're at a girls' school, then that type of dumbing down doesn't click in. So I think it was a blessing, even though I didn't like it at all. In hindsight, I think it was probably good. Yeah. Please unfold pratyajna, or pratyabhijna, P-R-A-T-Y, pratya, B-H-I-J-N-A. Pritya, Pritya Bhigna, and Sakshi in relation to each other. If possible to talk about the Pancha Mahayagna, what the essence of each one is and how we can include that in our daily life as a Westerner and Grihastha. So with the Pritya Bhigna, everybody remember me kind of bringing this term up? So we were using the term, the verse, on waking dream, deep sleep. You know, that what we call the avastatraya sakshi, the witness of the three states of experience. And in that example, there's this one thing I wanted to teach, and remember I said I forgot this one thing and I wanted to teach it. Well, now I remember it, so I'm going to teach it right now. There is a piece of logic that we can apply in so many different levels. It's called anvaya vyatireka. Anvaya means a coherence. When this is, that is. The vyatireka is a negation of that coherence. When we would say like this. When this is, that is. It goes like this. So the anvaya is this. When this is, that is. Then the negation is when this is not, that is not. Right? So if both the anvaya, the positive coherence and the negative coherence, in the sense that when the one isn't, the other isn't. If both of those are in line, when this is, that is, when this is not, that is not, okay, then when that's the situation, there is no, you can say there's really no relationship between those two things. Or no, what I mean is that there really is a relationship between those two things, right? Because when this is, that is, and when this is not, that is not. So that says that there's some sort of very strong relationship. One is a quality of the other or something like that, because they depend on each other. If this is there, that is, but if this is gone, that's gone also. And so they use the example of the day, just as an example. When the day is, when the sun is, the day is. When the sun is down, the day is not. Right? And so that shows you that the day is totally, that for there to be day, it's totally dependent on the sun, because when the sun's not there, the day is not there. When the sun is, the day is. So then there's a really strong coherence or relationship. But what if the situation is different? Like, when this is, that is. Okay, so now there could be a coherence, there could be a strong relationship, because when this is, that is. But then what if in the negation, it's when this is not, that still is? What does that tell you? That there's no real relationship, because this, when this is, that is, but when this is not, that still is. It means that I can be without that. If I can be without that, then I'm not dependent on that to be. See what I mean? So now, in terms of the waking dream, deep sleep states, When the waking state is, I am. It's fine. But when the dream state is, I still am. And the dream state replaces the waking state in terms of my experience. When I'm dreaming, the waking state is completely, not I would say replaced. Experientially, it's replaced. So when the waking state is, I am. But when the dream state is, I still am. And so there is something about me that is not replaced. Experientially, I'm talking. You can say, well, the body's still there and the world's still there. We know that. But I'm not talking about what other people know. I'm talking about your experience, your self-experience. And your self-experience, you can't take a piece out of it, you know? Like sometimes the self-experience is there and sometimes it's not. No, that's not how it works, you know? Who you are, the self-experience, that which is non-objectifiable, that is really the truth of your being, you can't take a piece out of it. And so now we say, okay, in the waking state, I am there. And everybody says, yes, yes, yes. And you think, I'm there because when the body, mind, sense organs in the middle of the waking world. But yeah, of course I'm here. But then when you say, but when the dream is, which totally displaces the waking state, I still am. It's my dream. It's my waking state. It's my dream. So who is still there? The waking world is replaced by the dream world. The waking body-mind-sense organs is replaced by the dream body-mind-sense organs. So everything that I had taken, the waking experiences or memories even, are replaced, you know, by the dream character. That whole world is totally replaced. Friends, everything replaced. Situation, everything. But this is my waking state and this is my dream state. So what remains? What is the one, you know, that is left, that is me? Because I have no doubt that this is my waking state and my dream. I don't think, well, this is my waking state, but I don't really know whose dream that was. No, that was my dream. So who's the my there? Who's the me there? And that me, it's not even going to be a knower, because the knower and what is being known by the waker, the waking character, is different than what is being known by the dream character. They're both knowers, but they're knowers in a totally different situation with totally different bodies. So what is my nature, you know? What is my nature? And that's what we call prakriya, teaching methodology, is used to advance the teaching methodology of seer seeing. Because in the seer seeing, you realize that in the waking state itself, all of these things that you had taken yourself to be are objectified. Your body, the subject object, your body becomes an object, your mind becomes an object, you know, your sense organs are an object, the eye thought is an object. All this thing, everything that you had taken to be yourself is objectified, and you, the subject, remain. Having been your own being, having given up knowership and seership and thoughts and emotions and the physical body, you remain. Okay? And so now that you that remains, when we do this prakriya, this teaching methodology of waking dream, the sakshi of the waking dream deep sleep state, who remains? Now in terms of your daily cycle between waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state, who remains? It's me, the Atma, who is not a knower. I am just conscious being. In fact, the dream state proves that I am not a knower. I mean, the deep sleep state proves that I am not a knower, because in the deep sleep state, when the mind is withdrawn, there's no seer seen, hearer heard, thinker thought, no one in having emotions or anything. There is no knowership. There's just me, conscious being. And this me is the self of the waker and the waking state, the self of the dreamer, dreaming state, and the self of the deep sleep state, which is in such a, where the mind and sense organs are in such a condition that they can't comment on that state. But when you wake up from that state, you can comment on it, and you say, I slept so well, right? And the deep sleep was, I slept so well, I was out like a light, nothing disturbed me, it was the most wonderful sleep. I can't believe I can enjoy a sleep as much as that, you know. So now what does that mean? I'm very clear, my mind is very clear, because it's the commentator here, that the one who was in the waking state is the one who was in the dream state, is the one of the deep sleep state. That recognition of myself being the self of these three is what we call pratyabhijna. It's a type of memory or recognition. Whereas when I think of citta or memory, I'm thinking of, oh, I remember I once had this experience, and then I had this experience, and this thing happened to me, etc. I have so many memories, you know, or if I'm memorizing my vibhaktis or something, I know these are all memories that I have, right? But they're all objectified memories. Whereas the pratyabhijna is not exactly a memory. It is in a sense, but it's more of a recognition, a memory of my own presence, that yes, I was there. Yes, I was there. And so the pratyabhijna is a memory of my own presence in these different situations or vrittis even that replace each other or displace each other. But in each vritti, I remember, yes, I was there. I was the one who had that experience. I was the one who had that experience. That's the pratyabhijna. And then it's really exemplified in a way in the waking dream deep sleep, because I have a pratyabhijna there. That when, because everything, the whole waking universe and everyone in it, including this body, mind, sense organs, is displaced in the dream. And yet I have a pratyabhijna that the one who was the waker is the one, is the me who is the dreamer. And then when all duality is displaced by just one big ajnanam vritti, when I don't know, you know, where there's no duality present, I still recognize that was my deep sleep, not somebody else's. So that pratyabhijna is a type of memory which acknowledges all of these states of experience belonging to me. And everything that would normally identify as me is displaced by those experiences, especially obviously in the waking dream and deep sleep. So that subject-object differentiation becomes even driven home even further after you do the drisha viveka, to then bring in the waking dream and deep sleep and see, yeah, even in these huge changes in these avastas that really displace each other, like the here's one avasta, this whole waking state, and then the whole dream state and the whole absolute ajnanam. There's still that pratyabhijna. Everything about me is negated. But actually, everything that you are not is negated. You remain. But you don't remain with any type of nama-rupa. No name and form, no seer seen. Just you. That's another really important thing to recognize, that in the waking, dream, deep sleep, you are there. Just think of the logic here, or what you actually say. You say, yes, I had this dream. So what right now, I know I'm in the waking state, I said, yes, I had that dream. That means that the very me that you identify with right now as yourself, even though you've loaded that self with the body and the mind and the sense organs, you know, it's like you've put on all of these dresses and you don't realize they're only dresses, you know. But the very me that you take to be you, right, is the one who is the self of the dreamer and is the one who is the deep sleeper. And so yourself is what remains. The self that is you right now is the self that is there in all those three states of experience. You misidentify your being with these things that are objectified. You take yourself to be that. But you are not that at all. And you don't feel like when you say that was my dream, you don't say, well, you know, a little piece of me was carried over into the dream, just a little tiny bit of me. No, it was me. I was there. All of me, me, was there, not part of me. So the me is Atma. The me experience that makes you say me, I am, that is the Atma. That Atma, if you take off the dress of the body, mind, sense organs, I'm still exactly the same. They're not touching me at all. They're mithya. Mithya means they don't have any, I am their being, completely, 100%, the being of something that is mithya. They have no, mithya has no being of its own, right? So that pratyabhijna is very useful if it's understood to recognize, it's just a kind of a logic or putting a word, important word to your experience, the experience of your continuity, you know, in all of these experiences that displace each other, right? Oh, you have to go? We'll see you both soon, I hope.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, beautiful.
See you next time. Yeah.
Carefully, catch your plane on time. Let me just check in with you. It's now a little after 6:30. Should we stop? Because I only have three questions left, rock questions tonight. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could stop. Maybe we could do one bhajan.
Okay.
Yeah. And then that would be beautiful. And then we'll stop. You want to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Bhakta Maruti, Parama Bhakta Maruti, Bhakta Maruti, Parama Bhakta Maruti.